Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. Welcome to Bookworm, a book I just loved reading, and a writer that I love to talk to are on. It's George Saunders with his book, A Swim in a Pond in the Rain. Well, the subtitle will tell you it all, in which four Russians give a master class on writing, reading, and life. Now, these four Russians, why don't you name them, George?
Oh, sure. It's Chekhov, Turgenev, Gogol, and Tolstoy.
So we notice right away, how come no Dostoevsky? Why these four?
Well, the book is based on a class I've been teaching for 20 years at Syracuse. So Dostoevsky is in that class, as is Isaac Babel and a bunch of other people. But the goal was to try to set the book up so that I could provide the full text of the stories that we're going to talk about, try to simulate the classroom so the reader reads the story and then we talk about it. So it became kind of this crazy Rubik's Cube of, okay, how long are the stories? How long are my essays? How many can I fit? And most importantly, over the years, those 20 years of teaching these stories, which are the seven that kind of teach the best? The stories aren't necessarily my favorites even. They're just the ones that over the years have always, you know, given the classroom that little pop where they're just, for some reason, they're just really good, bodies to have on the slab, I guess you could say.
With the perhaps exception of a very close reading of Robert Frost's long poem, Home Burial, by Randall Jarrell, this is the most exciting work of interpretation and easily the most exciting book about writing and reading that I've ever read. It's not easy to do, and George has managed in seven chapters, each punctuating one of the stories. The stories are printed in full, so you'll get to read the stories and then have a virtual discussion about them with George. And George and I have spoken about his work many times, but I didn't know how sensitive he was to the work of others, especially, basically, the 19th century Russian writers. Now tell me, George, do you think that this writing is so good because of what was going on in Russia at the time? Russia was in a state of revolution and extremity. Writers were needed to tell people what was going on. Is that what makes this writing so incredibly great? Rereading these stories, I was moved from head to toe. When I got to your chapter on Chekhov's The Nose, I was physically trembling with excitement, both because of the story and because of what you and your classes have had to say about it. Do the times account for their greatness, George?
You know, Michael, one of the things, one of the kind of caveats I made for myself writing the book was that I'm not really an expert on the history or certainly I don't speak or read Russian, but I think you're exactly right in that this time was, story's form itself was fairly new, so sort of like hip-hop is, people are just discovering what the form could hold. But also, it was such a wrenching time with a lot of suppression. So people were coming in trying to tell the truth sideways so the censors wouldn't cut it out. And also, this was the main way that the culture was trying to make sense of itself in a time of real emergency. So I think it was a sort of a perfect storm of things that made this a particularly, you know, it was a form at that time that understood itself to be dealing with moral, ethical questions. And the questions were not abstract. They were life or death. Because of the censorship, you couldn't just come right out and write a directly political story. So you had to come at it a little slantwise, which I think you could argue added to the power of these stories.
Yes, writing on a slant, writing through indirection, and at the same time, writing stories that feel so clear and so direct that you don't suspect them of indirection. The slant is perfectly concealed.
You know, I've always felt in our culture, in American culture, that there was a little bit of suspicion about writing that wore its ethics or its moral intentions on a sleeve. But there, I think they didn't have that worry. They sort of understood that when you sit around the metaphorical campfire, you're supposed to be talking about things that are important. And the things that are important are small in experience, but very large in their existential implications.
Somehow I thought the importance of the writing in those times carried over in your book to our sense of crisis, catastrophe, and emergency in our own time. And so for some reason, not only did I feel that your book was directly addressing me, I felt it was addressing the things that we don't yet know how to say about our times. And you talk about your students at Syracuse University. You choose six a year out of some 600 or 700 applications, and that these are already coming in as some of the best writers in the country. Some of them are going to be among our great writers, and you say you're teaching them how to express their iconic space. That is to say, you're teaching them, each of them, what makes them most themselves. And as we read this terrific book, which is A Swim in a Pond in the Rain by my guest George Saunders, we see what makes Tolstoy so different from Chekhov, what makes Chekhov so different from Gogol, and what makes them all so different from Turgenev. Now, everyone keeps saying that this is no longer the time of writing and reading. I disagree, but what do you think about the future, George?
Well, I'm on your side, Michael. I think there's an underground network of people who read, and I know you know them through the wonderful show that you have, and I have met them, you know, at these readings and at signing tables. And so my sense is maybe what the narrative in our country has to do with numbers, how many people read as opposed to how many people, you know, go to movies or whatever. But for me, the thing is, if you have one really intense reader, that person is often disproportionately influential in the culture. So when I do a reading, there's 700 people out there, and I'm talking to 300 of them afterwards. These are people who are really living energetically, and they really, you know, they're taking what they read to heart. They're being changed by it, and they're living according to it. So I think that we probably, in the public frame, we underestimate the power of reading and of thought and of critical self-reflection and everything. But also, I think in terms of the resources educationally, in my lifetime, I feel like we've been gradually backing away from really saying out loud that reading matters. You know, I this is anecdotal, but our kids went to a really good school, and for most of the time, they had this thing called declamation, which is the kids would memorize a 4 or 5 page swath of something and perform it publicly. And then that got cut.
Really?
And the idea was the parents found it a little gauzy, and they found it that it was too hard for the kids who couldn't do it, and so it went away. Science fair, math fair, all that continued, and it was such a beautiful thing to hear, and you could see the kids getting inside the text that they were memorizing. Our daughter memorized an incredibly hard Carl Sandburg whole story, did such a magnificent reading of it, and it just quietly went away because by sort of common assent, it was a little too, you know, poofy or something. I don't know. So I think that's across the culture. There's that kind of just gradual agreement that literature is not actually that important. And, you know, of course, we know that it's the cornerstone, really.
I'm of Russian descent, and my grandmother, who moved here with her children, my mother was the only one born in America. So my mother spoke to me in a combination of English and Yiddish, and my grandmother spoke to me in a combination of Russian and Yiddish. And when I read these stories again, as I did in reading your book, I feel that they're talking directly to me. You make a point and you say that you don't like to call the thing we call plot, you don't call it plot, you call it significant or resonant action. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the book partly is, you know, it's four writers and it's, I don't really have the chops to do anything but talk about these stories through a writer's mind. You know, I'm not a scholar and not a critic, but so at Syracuse, I talk about this idea called self-gaming, which is that a young artist has to agree with herself to think about writing in only those terms that help her be productive. So if if a writer comes up to an essay on plot and it gives her anxiety and blocks her up, then she should walk away from it and maybe find another way to think about this thing, plot, which is just a concept anyway. So for me, thinking about plot, I don't know what to do. Thinking about three-act structure makes me constipated. But if I just think of it in terms of a conversation I'm having with the reader, and the conversation wants to be a two-way, intimate, fun conversation, then I think all of these technical concepts come out of that. And it's a more natural way for me to think about my own writing, but also to think about reading, that basically you're reading a line at a time and something is happening inside of you. And if that thing is good, you keep going. And if you keep going, a sort of pattern of expectation and satisfaction arises. So in a certain way, a writing education is just finding, you know, sort of a handful of folksy metaphors and scale models that you can use in your mind. And the goal really is just so you don't get blocked up and fail to do your work.
Well, I want you to take a step back from yourself, George, and see that you did much more in this book. I mean, I've been someone who's been doing the program that you're on right now and have been on many times before for 32 years, which is to say I read a book a week, every week for 32 years, if possible, the rest of the books by the author. What you've done is somehow you've stepped to the center of the stage to make reading and writing exciting and significant. You say at the beginning that a short story has no room for waste space. And so going through these stories, the first one you go through page by page, it's an early exercise of yours, it's a checkoff, and you show how there's nothing in the story that's thrown away, irrelevant, or wasted. And gradually, as the reader, including me, moves story by story, I see how in George Saunders' eyes, meaningful action occurs on every single page and in every single paragraph. You're not just teaching a writer how to read, you're teaching a reader how to read, and you're teaching us all the importance and thrill of reading close so that we interpret what's going on as meaningful, not just, as you say, the report of a webcam, but the report of a heart and a mind reporting on life itself. But George, I feel that you loved writing this book, and the love carried over to me in a very powerful way. Was this a real joy to work on?
Yes, and thank you for saying that, Michael. That means a lot to me. I took it on a little bit feeling like I wanted to recharge after Lincoln Lombardo and kind of go back to the source, you know, like how did I feel about stories when I was 20? And I kind of thought it would be quick. I thought it would be, you know, just I have those notes, I'll just type them up. And as you intuited in the process, it became this sort of beautiful experience of going up to the writing room every day and feeling that I was, you know, on one level that I was deferring my real work, which is to write fiction. But slowly realizing that no, this is actually the real work right now. And to submit, you know, to submit to these writers again and again and say, okay, I actually don't understand these stories even after teaching them for 20 years. Let me really go down into the dish and figure out how they work. And it started to become just a beautiful dream. You know, like at the end of the day, I'd put it away, go back down, and just be looking forward to coming back up the next day. And it was really that the stories were teaching me every day.
During the course of your career, George, I think that your writing has grown better and better. By the time of Lincoln in the Bardo, your last book, a novel, you really had reached the place where you astonished me, as opposed to the place you'd been before, where you'd frequently surprised me. Lincoln in the Bardo kept breaking my heart, and now that you've written this book, I see who the author of Lincoln in the Bardo is. I thought I knew the author of Pastoralia and Civil War Land and Bad Decline, but the author of Lincoln in the Bardo was new to me. You've gotten deeper and deeper, and I think that Russian writing has helped you to get there. You took risks in that book that only a Russian would take.
I love that. But isn't that the beautiful thing about this reading and writing is that it works against our usual internal narrative, which is that we're fixed. You know, we've been the same person since we were a little kid, and we just have to deal with it. And it says, no, actually, you've never been the same person for a moment. And you hopefully are growing, and writing and reading is a way to somehow temporarily quiet down the self so that something else can show up. So I've been loving these Russian writers forever, since maybe college. But for a long time, the kind of simplicity and goodness in them, I just felt like, yeah, I can't do that. That's beyond me. But I can kind of look back and go, the trajectory of my career has been trying to find a way to be in the same ballpark with these writers who are so open to life and you know, are able to represent positive phenomenon, which I think is the hardest thing to do technically. And it may be, I mean, this is another discussion, but it may be that one of the, you know, the difficulties in this era is that we've lost the ability to express gratitude or transcendence or just simple good actions on the page.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm. I'm talking with George Saunders about his new book, a great book. It's called A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, in which four Russian masters give a master class on writing, reading, and life. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with George Saunders about his new book, A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, in which four Russians give a master class on writing, reading, and life. And this book explores what writers want to know, how a reader's mind works, and the reader's mind, when it's reading, is working to figure out what a writer's mind is like. And so George describes that cross current as a form of connection that is extremely profound, carefully worked out. George once went to mining school where he was an engineer, and figuring out how things work is one of the most exciting aspects of this book. Figuring out how they work, why they work. I've never read a book about writing that interested me anywhere near this much. This is the book to, for my listeners, this is the book to read. There's a swim in a pond in the rain in the story Gooseberries by Chekhov. How did this become the title of your book?
Well, you know, as I say in the book, there was a really important moment for me when, as a young grad student with his head up his rear, I heard Tobias Wolff, our teacher, read. He read the what's called the Little Trilogy, which is Gooseberries at the middle, and then Man in a Case, and About Love on either end. And he kind of sprung it on us. I think he was going to read from his work, but he announced that he was going to read Chekhov. And so he read it, and I don't know. I'd read Chekhov before, and I thought, yeah, it's okay, but the language is a little boring, and you know, all these middle class people, because I was, you know, 26 or something. And when he read that story, it was the most entertaining, in the deepest sense of the word, the most entertaining thing I'd ever heard. Every sense was engaged. The whole room was one unit, and we were bringing all of our experience to the stories. You know, he's getting a lot of laughs and a lot of deep sighs, and so for me, that was a great moment just to sort of go, okay, this is actually what I'm going to do with my life, and better get going, because this is not kid stuff. You know, to write a story like that takes a kind of a technical chops, but also felt to me it took a kind of wisdom for Chekhov to have, you know, to have understood people in this way. I'd always thought that he was a moral writer because he sort of gave us an example of a character doing the correct thing, which actually isn't the case in many of the stories, and the ones in this book. He sort of does a kind of weird holographic thing where he makes three or four opinions that seem to contradict or at least clash. And then he makes them so well that they just hang there in the air. And the effect is not to tell you what the right way to live is or which character was correct, but rather to sort of re-engage your questioning. So it's an ambiguity exercise. And so then at the heart of that is a beautiful moment in this story where this guy who is later to make a beautiful speech against happiness that we kind of buy into is shown to be swimming joyfully in this pond while it's raining. And so I thought that's in a sense, that's Russian literature in a nutshell, is the, you know, three or four contradictory statements hanging in the air, beautifully rendered. And we turn to the writer and we go, which one is true? And he says, yeah, all of them. See you later.
When I was young, I loved Dostoevsky. I mean, does any young person who reads Crime and Punishment escape that book alive? You never forget it. And, you know, I went way beyond. I read The Brothers Karamazov. I just read and read. And I loved Tolstoy. Recently, an independent group of readers read War and Peace under the direction of Yi-Yun Lee. And I couldn't believe how brilliant Tolstoy was, how hilarious when I read him here Gogol is, but I've always thought so. But I thought that Chekhov was, as you originally put it, kind of bland. I didn't realize how much you have to surrender. Now, you have to understand, as hard as it is to say, that Chekhov, this Chekhov, who was a doctor, the author of some of the greatest plays that the theater knows, not just Russian plays, and the author of brilliant short stories and a report exploring the villages of Russia and the diseases there, this Chekhov died at age 44. I mean, almost astounding to think about. And in other words, he was a young person. I believe that the wisdom that emerges from Chekhov's short stories emerges because he's young, barely, you know, past his, you know, uncivilized years. And the wisdom is emerging from the behind the clouds of the story. The wisdom is speaking against happiness while showing the character being happy and saying, how is it that this very person does not believe in happiness? What Chekhov does is to discover the ways we all believe the opposite of what we do, because it's so much easier to be oppositional. He is, to my mind, the first heartbreaker in literature, and the first time I actually understood what a writer was doing. And it seems like it's that way for you too, George.
With Chekhov, you see that he's, first of all, not a realist in any way, shape, or form. Everything in these stories is so exaggerated and compressed and chosen. And so you see that he's making a matrix of vivid, let's say, vignettes or representations. And the meaning is coming out of the way he juxtaposes those. So, for example, in a story that I don't teach in this book, because it's too good, Lady with Pet Dog, he's got it's a series of little gems that speak to one another across the pages of the book. It looks so incidental. It looks very almost anecdotal. But when you take that thing apart, it's just amazing how engineered it is. And the purpose of the engineering seems to be destabilization of the too easy concept. Or you could say destabilizing our ability to understand a person as fixed and either hero or villain. Because I kept opening these stories up and I'm like, I can't believe that this exists. And I wonder if he, you know, to what extent did he know it? Was it intentional? Was it just intuition? But it's almost like you're seeing an entire very advanced philosophical system broken into shards and rearranged into bits of prose, you know.
I'm talking with George Saunders, and we're going to continue talking to George Saunders about this book, A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, next week. The book is published by Random House. It's a masterclass on writing, reading, and life. Thank you, George, for joining me, and we're going to continue next week.
Thank you, Michael.
I want to tell my listeners that due to the pandemic, we're each taping from our respective residences, so you may hear occasional unusual sounds. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at Apple, Spotify, and all other podcast services. It can also be listened to on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. I get word about the show from people listening all over the world. I consider it to be my great privilege to be able to talk to you all. Special thanks to my Bookworm Show collaborators, Alan Howard and Sean Sullivan. The engineer today is Desmond Taylor, and the technical director is PJ Shahamat. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a book. He is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.